In the fall of 2003, Anya Ciazadlo spent her honeymoon in Baghdad. She moved to Beirut with her husband and spent the next 6 years between the two cities, cooking and eating with Shiites and Sunnis, refugees and warlords, matriarchs and mullahs. In her upcoming memoir, Day of Honey, which will be published by the Free Press next February in 2011, she brings a political, historical, and cultural perspective to the everyday struggle to find and prepare food during wartime. From the Iraqi couple who drove all over bomb-strewn Baghdad to find a bakery open so that they could buy a birthday cake for their daughter, to learning family recipes from her Lebanese mother-in-law, Anya discovers the people during wartime need food to feed the soul as much as to feed the body. Anya has written about culture, politics, and the Middle East for many prominent publications, and she was a special correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. She currently lives somewhere between New York and Beirut with her husband, the journalist Mohammed Bazzi. Please welcome Anya Ciazadlo.
So I had actually planned to start off by describing the book, but I guess no, I don't have to do that. Very briefly, if anybody wants to know more, Mohammed very kindly printed up a bunch of flyers, so you can go to him for those afterwards or come to me. I'm going to give you a brief introduction. I chose to read something from relatively late in the book because it combined the elements of food and war, in this case, sectarian riots, more than any other scene, and it included pretty much my favorite character in the book, which is Mohammed's mom. And she's somebody who, I'm going to explain a little bit about her, because at this point in the book, there's a couple of things you need to know. First of all, she's one of my favoriteest people in the whole world. She is not somebody you'd want to mess with. She's also, she kind of took over the book in an interesting kind of way. She's also very hard of hearing. And so whenever we converse, which we do in this sort of broken Arabic that I speak, there's always a lot of shouting. And there's always a lot of kind of like, what? What did you say? What do you mean? What are you talking about? What do you mean? So this chapter begins about 3 months after, actually 4 months after the end of the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. And this war, which lasted for only 33 days, was incredibly devastating in Lebanon. But at the end of the war, Hezbollah had declared a divine victory. And so this was this phrase that you saw everywhere, plastered on posters all over town, on roads, on piles of rubble, burned out buildings. And about 3 months after the divine victory, Hezbollah declared that it was going to try to bring down the American-backed government in Lebanon. And so Hezbollah and a lot of sort of political allies, like political parties that were aligned with Hezbollah, called a big demonstration and flooded into downtown Beirut, which has always been sort of a battleground, in addition to being just a groovy place where you go and eat and shop and do other things. Historically in Beirut, it was sort of this dividing line ran through it. And so it's always been this very contentious place, in addition to being a really fun and very precious place. So in December, they called this big demonstration. A bunch of people went downtown. And in the beginning was actually, interestingly enough, it was sort of a broad-based thing. It was a lot of Christians. There are a couple of Christian parties aligned with Hezbollah. And a lot of people in the demonstration weren't even necessarily Hezbollah supporters. I spent a lot of time down there talking to people, and a lot of them would say things like, well, you know, Hezbollah, whatever. I'm really not really down with their lifestyle, but you know, I want a cleaner government. The government in Lebanon is very corrupt. They would say things like, you know, I couldn't afford to eat in downtown Beirut. You know, we want more jobs. We want, you know, we want this sort of economic agenda. We want sort of a better Lebanon. Within a couple of months, that had deteriorated to the point where it was really only Hezbollah supporters, and it was very, very much focused on bringing down the government. I wrote a couple of articles about it for the New Republic, and sort of describing this, you know, this initial fun period as Hezbollah Palooza. By the end of December, it was kind of more just Hezbollah without the fun part. In January, Hezbollah called a strike, which I actually didn't really think was going to be any kind of big deal, because strikes here, you know. Strike in Lebanon, as in Europe, means a lot of burning tires, a lot of burning cars, sometimes burning buildings, sometimes fights, sometimes people die. And this particular strike ended up taking on a very ugly, very sectarian tone. There were checkpoints in our neighborhood, which is majority. I had always thought of it as a mixed neighborhood where all religions lived, but majority Sunni, apparently, at least according to some of the militiamen that we ran into. And it was a very, very scary experience for me, and I think probably for Muhammad, to be told by people in our neighborhood, our neighbors, that this is a Sunni neighborhood, there are no Shiites allowed in this neighborhood. Muhammad being Shiite, that was news to us because we were like, hey, we live here. So it was a very, very tense period in Beirut's history. There were checkpoints everywhere. There were snipers. There were curfews by the end of the week. By the end of the week, seven people had died in these sort of sectarian clashes that were going on. It was a situation of almost kind of leading toward ethnic cleansing checkpoints where they're checking people's ID and checking what religion they are, which had been a big feature of the Lebanese Civil War. So at this moment of incredible sectarian tension, a friend of ours named Reem, and what you need to know about her is she's a crazy friend of ours. She's a journalist. She's Polish, Syrian, and Canadian, and she worked for a Lebanese newspaper. At this point, when no one was really leaving their house, she showed up at our house and she said, hey, let's all go out to lunch. So that's the point where I'm going to start reading. That night, the army imposed a curfew for the first time since 1996. Four people had been killed and over 150 injured. There were checkpoints like the one in our neighborhood and other parts of the city, and snipers at the university just down the street from Hanan's apartment. Snipers, checkpoints, curfews. It seemed like the 17 years since the war had simply evaporated. By Saturday, the city was back to the angry, paranoid stasis that passed for normal in those days. People drove to work. Restaurants and stores stayed open, but they had very few customers. People went home and stayed by the television, waiting to see what would happen. Everyone except Reem, who came over from Jamezi with a car and an idea. All of Beirut was hunkering down, afraid to go outside. But downtown belonged to us, she pointed out, just as much as it did to any of the sectarian factions. She wanted to go downtown to the one area everyone was avoiding, above all others, and have lunch. We agreed. Why not? What about Hassan, said Reem as we got ready to leave. Why don't we bring her too? Hassan, do you want to go out with us? I just started drinking tea. Are you going to wait for me until I finish my tea? We'll wait for you. You should have told me before I started drinking. We'll wait for you. Where are you going? We're going downtown. We're going to eat. What do I want with food? I already ate. You should come with us. You can walk around. Walking around. I haven't been out in a while, she said thoughtfully. At this point, Hassan did something she had probably never done before in her life. She abandoned her tea. She changed into her best black cloak, the one Muhammad called her super haji robe, and called Hanan to brag that she was going downtown. Look at her, she's beaming, said Reem as we piled into her car. Hassan peered out the window of the front passenger seat. Muhammad and I rolled down the back windows and stuck our heads out like dogs. Reem was driving and laughing at the same time. We parked by Martyrs Square and started walking. Hassan limped fiercely toward the city center, clutching Muhammad's arm. Shubid di bilbalad, what do I want with downtown? She demanded loudly with a shrug that fooled no one. At the restaurant, we debated whether to sit inside or outside. Outside was more pleasant, but would Hassan be cold? She shrugged. Mituma bidkum, as you wish. Did she want to sit outside? She shrugged. Mituma bidkum. We sat outside, the better to enjoy the sights of downtown. The cobblestone streets, the stray cats. There was a little old man with Tourette's syndrome, a fixture of downtown Beirut. He walked around selling glossy posters of the old Martyrs Square and barking at tourists. He seemed to be the only other person downtown that day, and when he saw us sitting outside, he barked with joy. We already had some of his posters, but we bought another one, a sea blue photograph of pre-war Martyrs Square lined with palm trees and Art Deco movie palaces. The waitress brought menus. Don't get me anything, said Hassan. I don't want anything. I already ate. The waitress brought plates and laid down table settings. Why is she getting me a plate? Didn't you tell her I'm not eating? Keep the plate, just in case. I already ate. Did she want tea? I already drank tea. She drank it instantly, although it was scalding, and complained it was too cold. Did she want more? Shubid difi. What do I want with tea? We gave her some cold meze, hummus, stuffed grape leaves, and tabbouleh. She devoured them while protesting with her mouth full that she wasn't hungry. Her eyes lit up when the batata obeid arrived.
You're eating potato bait?
She said, drawing her head back, narrowing her eyes, and staring at it sideways. Yours is better, of course, I said, shoveling a big chunk of oily fried potatoes and eggs onto her plate. She ate it. Taibing, ma ish punchi, she sniffed. Literally, there's nothing wrong with it. A grudging not bad. Having praised the food, she surveyed the plates littering the table and sighed. Why didn't we stay at home? She shrugged. I would have made you potato bait. Reem turned to me. She always like this? She asked in English. Muhammad and I both laughed. This is nothing, I said. Usually, said Muhammad with pride, she's worse. The waiter stood over us with his hands clasped apologetically. They were shutting down early because there were no other customers but us. Did we want anything more before the kitchen closed? Reluctantly, we decided to go home. Then Reem had another idea. Did Hassan want to go see the tent city? Mitul mabitkum, as you wish. But then she added, maybe if you're going. In her language, the closest thing to yes. We walked through Sehat and Nijmi, and Reem bought a cloud of pink cotton candy bigger than her head. The old man barked with excitement to see us, his only customers, once again. Downtown is deserted, Reem kept saying. It's dead. When we reached the blue metal barricades that divided downtown in half, we stopped, suddenly hesitant to venture across to the other side. Well, we're here already, let's go, said Hassan, shrugging as though we'd been dragged there against our will. She walked through the barrier, and we followed. On the other side of the barricade, Hezbollah men huddled in canvas tents. Others swept up garbage. The strike had killed off the festive mood, and all that remained was hardcore party loyalists who stared at us and then looked away. A water tank was plastered with angry slogans and cartoons of the Prime Minister embracing Condoleezza Rice. Muhammad held his mother's arm as she hobbled down the street. Where do they have the big gatherings? She asked, looking eagerly from side to side. On television, she had seen tens, hundreds of thousands of people all waving and cheering. We showed her the big pink building where people had once assembled, but there were no more happy crowds now. No more children and families dancing debki. I'm not sure exactly what we expected. Some pride, perhaps, in the spectacle of Shiites taking over downtown. But after a minute, she stopped, looked around, and frowned. Look at them! They're just sitting around, she declared, at the volume of an old woman hard of hearing. Hezbollah men turned and glared at us with clenched faces. They're not working, she said, sweeping her arm to encompass the whole city of tents. Your mom's going to start a civil war, I hissed. Muhammad tried to shush her, but this only made her louder. They're sitting with neither work nor trade, she crowed, using a southern expression for lazy idle slackers. They're getting paid, they just sit around. Hezbollah is known for many things, but grace under criticism is not one of them. I imagine what we must look like to the Hezbollah men crouched resentfully in their tents. Two non-headscarved women, one of them eating pink cotton candy and wearing a cherry red jacket. One cranky old Heji, barely able to walk, supported by her son, who seemed to have brought her to the tent city expressly so she could parade through and tell them they were bums. Perhaps Hassan's bintajbil accent and black hijab saved her. Perhaps it was her super haji robe. More likely, they had orders not to interfere with visitors. In any case, the shabab contented themselves with dirty looks, and we hustled her home as quickly as we could. The minute we walked in the door, she descended on the phone and started calling relatives. She was eager to lord it over them. She had been downtown. She had seen the tents. We retreated to the balcony to wallow in relief. I guess her sectarian loyalties only go so far, I said. Muhammad laughed. As you know, she has no compunction telling people how she feels about them, he said. She doesn't hold back. He looked sideways at me. I guess that's why I married you, he added. Maybe you're not so different from her after all. A week later, the military fortified the barricades that divided each side from the other. They dragged in thick gray concrete walls. They wreathed them in festive snarls of concertina wire. Everyone thought of the old green line that had once split downtown in two. The barriers were necessary to keep people from crossing over and fighting, they said, and possibly starting another civil war. But you know the real reason they put up those barriers, right? I told Muhammad. They put them up to keep your mother out of downtown. That's it.
I'm happy to introduce our second reader, Nathan Duell. Since graduating from Deep Springs College, Nathan Duell has been a writer and editor For such publications and websites as Rolling Stone, The Atlantic Monthly, The Village Voice, The National, NPR.org, and 6billion.org. In the summer of 2007, he quit his job, packed a bag, and walked from New York to New Orleans, a trek that took 5 months, 3 pairs of shoes, and a couple thousand miles. He currently lives in Saudi Arabia with his wife, NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers, but I learned recently the couple will be moving to Istanbul soon when Kelly takes over the Baghdad correspondent position for NPR, so that's very exciting. Tonight, Nathan will be reading about a Thanksgiving dinner in Riyadh, I believe. Nope, he won't. He'll be reading something different. Who knows? It's exciting. Please welcome Nathan Duell.
Hi, thanks for coming on this beautiful night. Really appreciate it. My name is Nathan Duell. Like Aaron said, we lived in Riyadh for 18 months, and I have two stories for you, and both of them are true. The first one's called Night of the Gun. After living for 6 months in Muhammad's apartment, a 1980s unit in central Riyadh with tall ceilings, dark windows, roaches, and fluorescent lights, I could no longer dodge his repeated invitations to visit his farm. And so, on a Thursday afternoon this winter, my wife Kelly and I loaded up our rented Toyota and headed north. As we drove further into the desert, I looked hungrily for exit 4, the only usable clue I had divined from my Saudi landlord's excited over-the-phone directions. Aware that I had no idea how far we needed to go, I fought off a mounting feeling of dread by telling Kelly what I knew of our host. I'd come to know Muhammad gradually, first as we negotiated the rental price, then on an appliance purchasing trip, then over Pepsi one night at his family's vacation house in Riyadh. He was born, he told me, in 1963, one of 12 sons of an upper-class family. He'd attended junior high in Los Angeles while his father was studying in America. After graduating from a Saudi high school, he began working for SABIC, the sprawling Saudi petroleum and plastics company. He started in the warehouse, rose steadily through the ranks, and eventually was sent by the company to study at Boston University. Upon his return, he did well enough that he could retire in his 40s and move his wife and children from their dark apartment, where we lived, into a Riyadh mini-mansion. Last year, tired of the conservative capital, he bought a farm in the desert. After an hour of driving, I found exit 4 and looped up and over a bridge that spanned the expressway. One of those Toyota pickups with red racing stripes was speeding toward us, kicking up great clouds of sand. My phone rang, and I picked it up. "Is it you?" Muhammad purred. We followed his truck off the road and into the dirt, bouncing over rocks and diving deep into ruts. When I first met Muhammad to negotiate over his old apartment, he had whipped out his cell phone to show me photos of his new dream house. Apparently, just as he'd finished erecting the place, a flash flood had struck. I saw in the grainy snapshots that a great river of mud had knocked over palms, threaded great fissures in retaining walls, and filled his pool with brown slurry. "Come visit some weekend," he said, when I handed over the first 6 months' rent. "It will be nice." As we rounded a bend, the house came into focus, a three-story sand-colored castle with a moat, scalloped walls, and acres of desert. We parked behind his truck on an insanely steep driveway that had probably made more sense on paper, then sat outside at a plastic table, where Muhammad took deep pulls from a 5-foot shisha and drank a homemade concoction of dark purple juice, which we declined. Growing emotional, Muhammad began telling us how his family had been a powerful tribe for centuries. There had been a battle here, right where we were sitting, just after the Prophet's time. The leader of his tribe, he told us with an air of melancholy, had led his men straight into the strongest part of enemy lines. Spears had pierced his horse's chest, Muhammad said, but the leader had pushed on. "I call my land the..." Muhammad paused, frustrated. "You know, it is the horse, the breast of the horse." He pointed to his chest. "The chest of the horse? Yes, yes, that is the one." There was silence. A few moments later, Muhammad brightened a bit, pulled out his wallet, took out a well-worn identification card, and handed it to Kelly. "Nice mustache," she said. It was Muhammad's Boston University ID card, dated 1984 to 1985. His kids sometimes wanted to play with it, Muhammad said, but wary of the card faring, he wouldn't let them anymore. "I hate this fucking place," he said. Lately, he confided it was his kids that were causing him the greatest pain. He was happily married, but his wife's brothers were more conservative than Muhammad liked. "They take my kids and enroll them in summer school," he said. "When they come back, they talk like little bin Ladens. It's bullshit." We piled into Muhammad's truck for a tour of the property and the ruins of the old village. I was surprised to find that he was actually farming the rocky land with groundwater from deep wells. There were rows of palms and a 30-foot plot of peppers, spring onions, and eggplants. Once past the gates, he drove at breakneck speed through a moonscape of rock and fossilized sea creatures. "When did Columbus discover America?" he asked playfully, losing the smile and growing serious as he waited for my answer. "In 1492, I said reflexively, nearly in sing-song. "This village is much older than that," Muhammad said, sourly, no joy in his words. He tapped the steering wheel absentmindedly and drove faster. Soon we pulled up to the ruins, then got out and walked along the deep grooves left in the hard rock by water. There were sand and mud walls some 20 feet high and the remains of a 3-story guard tower. I fingered the rough walls, seeing that the constant assault of wind and occasional rain was revealing the stones that made the wall strong. As the sun set, Muhammad sighed and offered to take photos, but I could tell he was ready to leave. Back at the house, we retook our seats and Muhammad resumed sipping his purple drink. It was almost nightfall. I sheepishly told him we would probably need to leave soon. "I'm not going to kidnap you," he said solemnly, and became silent again. He urged more of the purple juice on Kelly, who declined, saying she was not thirsty. "Take some," he slurred. "No," Kelly said. Muhammad sat heavily back in his chair, murmuring something about always having to drink alone. "Next time, you must bring your friends," he said. It had grown cold with the setting sun, and it was hard to picture our friends agreeing to come out here, even after Muhammad started a small fire and began to grill marinated chicken. "I want to show you something," he told me. I followed him inside where the lights were low and the only furnishings were carpets and pillows. We headed upstairs, snaking through empty, echoing rooms. In a darkened hall, he reached up into the back of a cupboard and brought out a small, gray pistol. I started to panic. I didn't like the tightness of Muhammad's grip or his fingers' position on the trigger. Muhammad smiled and pointed the gun out a window. I pleaded with him to put it back. "Don't worry," he slurred, leveling the pistol, letting his arm rotate, his long white robe glowing in the moonlight. "It's not loaded," he said. "I just want to show it to you and your wife. I want you to see." Suddenly, he started stealing back down the stairs, through the darkened rooms, seeking my wife, who he could hear downstairs. "She hates guns," I said, dashing after him. "Please, don't do this." But he reached her before me, and I heard him say, as if in a trance, "This is my Spanish pistol." "How nice," Kelly said through clenched teeth. Out of breath, I gave her a wild look, then decided to take my landlord and would-be friend's arm and steer him outside, where we stood in the dark. "It's not loaded," he said, pulling the trigger again and again, the dry clicking echoing over the sand and under the moon. "It's not loaded. Nothing will happen tonight." At last, Muhammad put the pistol down on the plastic table. It was the final thing he would show us that day, hoping at long last for someone to see. But in the end, we didn't understand, and he couldn't explain. Okay, so that's the first story. For those of you who know me well know I do the waterworks sometimes when I read, so forgive me. For no good reason, really. So this second story is called Down a Dark Alley. It's March 2010, and the clang of metal rings out down a dusty street in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. Soldiers in blue camouflage hold oiled assault rifles, standing among a gathering crowd. One of the city's dispensaries for cooking gas has just received a shipment. There's a shortage of fuel all around the city, which is groaning under the twin strains of governmental dysfunction and an influx of refugees from the civil war in the north. A jet streaks high above us, presumably en route to Yemen's border with Saudi Arabia. Up there, the Yemeni army is fighting anti-government rebels and militants, allegedly run by a group of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Some in the West have begun to call Yemen a failed state, but at least they're calling it something. I have come to Sana'a with my wife, a reporter on assignment for National Public Radio, from our base in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. People say that Yemenis built Saudi Arabia, and it's true that big companies of Yemeni origin, such as the massive Bin Laden Group, were responsible for a lot of the early contracts to build roads and mosques and infrastructure in the kingdom. But warm relations between the two countries soured in 1990 and 1991 when Yemen's President Ali Abdullah Saleh voted against the United Nations resolution allowing the use of force to oust Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. Saudi Arabia was outraged by the decision and began deporting Yemeni guest workers. Nearly 1 million were eventually removed. the absence of dollar infusions from Saudi's booming oil economy, and the loss of millions in U.S. and European support didn't help things for Yemen, which itself faced dwindling oil revenues that are expected to slow to a stop soon. Coming from the comparative wealth and restrictions of Riyadh, I was eager to see Sana'a, but also wary. At the airport, the creaking wreck of hopeless bureaucracy is evident. There are multiple lines, but after 30 minutes, no one has moved forward. The men behind the computers have furrowed brows and regard their monitors quizzically. Their superiors run from terminal to terminal, yelling and reprimanding. Meanwhile, we all stand in the heat of the warming afternoon and swat at flies. As white American passport holders, we find ourselves dragged into the diplomatic lane, where the man behind the counter has sad eyes, James Dean hair, and bone structure that could land him any number of modeling contracts. He taps at the computer for a while, then stamps us through. We're in Yemen. Heading into the city, along the road where an Al-Qaeda suicide bomber attempted to blow up a Korean delegation last year, the line of cars slows for soldiers chewing massive cheekfuls of the herbal stimulant cot. They hold well-worn assault rifles and look glazed, yellow-eyed. We sail through the checkpoint, our driver giving a nod. He tells us they only stop men in beaten-up Toyota pickup trucks, the so-called jihadi mobiles. The North isn't some distant war, the driver explains. The fighting is not that far away, just a couple of hours by car. Partly because of all the strife here, and partly in spite of it, foreign aid money abounds in Sana'a, but it's not always easy to figure out what good it's doing. The Chinese embassy is massive, taking up an entire city block with 6-meter walls and armed guards. Chinese contractors are building the new parliament, which is paid for by Kuwait. Outside our hotel, a wedding tent has been erected and is promptly smothered in dust. Wailing live music rattles the walls all night, stopping for an hour or so to make way for the morning call to prayer. "It is better to pray than to sleep," the muezzin intones. The sun crests over Sana'a's millennia-old mud buildings. People have been lining up for hours to get hold of one of the bottles of cooking fuel. A typical Yemeni man, not much over 5 feet tall, dusty blazer, scarf thrown over his shoulders, dagger tucked into his belt, jostles to the front of the crowd. He knocks into another man who roars in protest. People shift nervously, including sandal-wearing children and several stooped women, who are shrouded in dyed fabrics and whose faces are covered with small black scarves. One of the soldiers shoves a man to the ground. There's disapproving tongue-clicking and bickering, and my wife and I realize it's probably time for us to get moving. We had our baby with us, too. One of the men in the scrum catches our eyes. He gives us an embarrassed smile. That afternoon, I prepare myself to see Sana'a's 2,000-year-old city, as it's called, a World Heritage Site and a place friends tell me is among the most enchanting sights they've ever seen. It's a half an hour's walk along cracked pavements smeared in green cot spit. What I encounter when I arrive is indeed a marvel. Behind the quarter's massive walls, I pick an insane path along narrow cobblestone alleys. The tall, narrow mud brick buildings reach for the blue sky. No angle is 90 degrees, and all the doors and windows are hand-carved and set with brass filigree and jeweled shards of stained glass. In one sun-dappled square, the air perfectly still, a girl picks lice out of another girl's hair. Down another shaded lane, barely wider than my outstretched arms, dirty-faced boys bang with sticks at an ornate manhole cover. Another knot of boys throws rocks at each other, and I am nicked in the playful barrage. Coming from Saudi Arabia, it's hard not to compare the open, jubilant street scene to the dour, joyless rush of Riyadh. Later that afternoon, there's a hawk prancing along the stone wall of a grassy square and a guy selling jasmine flowers with a rifle slung over his back. In a park, several men lounge in the shade of a tree, laughing as one cranks out sit-up after sit-up after sit-up. I shouldn't be so sanguine. I know I'm reaching for the fond anecdote, ignoring the grim for the reassuring image. On the way back to our room, I pass the military museum. A fierce-looking Italian tank with two guns stands outside. Men with daggers in their belts marvel, fingering the metal. Later that day, an alleged member of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula attempts to shoot his way out of a nearby hospital room. He kills one policeman and injures another. The next night, we race up to the old city in time to see the sun set from a rooftop restaurant. The call for evening prayer rings out, bouncing off ancient walls. 2 blocks from where we eat a mixed grill and sip hot chocolate, a 12-year-old girl will later struggle to explain to my wife why she doesn't want to be married anymore. After dinner, the power is cut for the entire district, and an all-consuming blackness descends. It's late. We are lost in the mix. I'm fearful we won't make it back. that the maze-like alleys will consume us. But the buzz of commerce pulls us along. Shopkeepers fire up generators and light candles. Along the way, we spot men watching a traffic jam just for something to do. In Yemen, it seems like there are as many hawks as there are pigeons. In turn, it sometimes seems like there might be as many jets flying overhead as there are hawks. On our last morning, I look out my hotel room window at the achingly blue sky, and I see a red plastic bag floating up on some warm slipstream. It's a whisper of petroleum soaring high above Sana'a, as light as air and as vexing and out of reach as anything else around here. Thank you.